The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Psychovetical Podcast. Can you hear the rain is falling on the roof here? Hope you can't hear that. What day is it today? Anyway, it's some day. before I go out in the rain, I thought I'd quickly do this podcast. My son just had some Nutella on his pancake, so he's hyper. So if you hear someone going around smashing into things, that's just him, so just ignore him. It's funny, Nutella's got, have you ever looked at, I think Nutella is something like, is it like 70% seed oils or something? It's I remember going past a Nutella factory in Italy, and it always, I always imagined it was this like kind of quite healthy because it's made out of nuts. And I remember like Mark Twight, he had a spoonful of Nutella, and so I saw a photograph of him eating some Nutella. And I thought, well, if Mark Twight eats Nutella, it must be pretty good. But anyway, it's got a lot of seed oils in it. So yeah, I'm one of those. I've turned into one of those like seed oil wankers who's like always going on about seed oils. Don't even know what they are. But anyway. So I once went on a trip and we had a lot of palm oil. We had like dried palm oil. So you could just put the palm oil, you know, you just have these flakes of palm oil and you would just like put them on your food. And I remember afterwards I was saying how good at palm oil was, and someone was like, oh, you can't have palm oil, it kills the palms or something, or something to do with some Indonesia or something, some kind of something. And I was like, oh, Christ, you can't even have a bit of palm oil on your bloody spaghetti without someone having a go at you. So anyway, and it's actually proper Nutella as well. It's like the real deal. So anyway, I haven't got long to do this podcast, which is good. I should probably bring up the fact that my last podcast, where I had a mini rant at the beginning, which was originally it was actually about how despairing I feel. I probably didn't say that, but how despairing I feel about the Ukraine thing going at the moment, because where we live, there's like a lot of Ukrainians. Like in Ireland, it's something like 31% of accommodation, like hotels, all that kind of stuff, is full of Ukrainians, and which is nothing wrong with that, apart from this kind of holiday season is fast approaching. Quite a lot of the Irish economy is based on tourism, and I kind of wondering what's going to happen. Like, what's going to happen to all these, like, poor Ukrainians? It's going to be like, because it's all, like, around here, it's all, like, women and children. And I think they're just going to get Afghanistan, where we're just going to wipe our hands of them. That's one of my main things at the moment. And I had a friend round the other day, someone staying, and I was like saying like how fucked it was in Ukraine, how, you know, Ukrainians are losing, and he was like, oh no, well, they're winning, and I was like, where do you get all your information from? He's like, I get it from Twitter. And I was like, oh Christ almighty, like it's We live in this kind of, I don't know if you've seen like Wag the Dog, the film Wag the Dog. I think you should, if you haven't seen it, definitely watch it. I feel like we're living in this world where there's like two wars going on. There's like the real war. Like we don't really get Russian propaganda because it's all blocked. We can't see what the Russians are saying. So we don't get any Russian propaganda really. And anyone who says anything that's against actual propaganda on our side is that we're told that's Russian propaganda, which often it's true. So there's this kind of war where you know you got Bear Grylls going to see Zelensky and all this kind of bullshit that's like bombarding me every day every time I switch on my phone. There's like pictures of Bear Grylls giving Zelensky chocolate or something, and then there's like the real war which is going on, which is you know, how many people have died? Like 500,000 people, you know. So it's So I think that was anyway. So I think that has been getting on my mind at the moment. But unfortunately, I probably gave those two female writers who'd written for UK Climbing. Was it unfair? I don't think it was unfair. But I suddenly had like a lot of people saying, oh, you sounded like you were deranged, or you sounded like women, bloody women. And basically calling me a misogynist and all that kind of stuff. I think when people use a lot of these modern words, I call them puppet words. So as soon as someone calls you like a misogynist or a racist or a transphobe, but one of these words, they're just a way of like someone putting their hand over your mouth and saying, you know, trying to stop you from saying something that could actually be valuable, but it's kind of breaking this. We kind of live in this like world of masks, like it's not a real, it's, you know, like we can't allow, like reality has been debunked. Like I've googled it, that's not true, you know. It says, you know, that's not a true thing. And in the first five searches on Google, that what you just said is not true. I said, well, if you go into like the, if you keep going down, eventually you'll find out, you know, most of the searches is true. So I guess back to the Ukraine, like, you know what, if I say that Ukraine are losing the war, and people say I've googled it and that's not true, so it's fake news or whatever it is. So I've basically lost several friends since that podcast, several guide friends, and it's like, don't talk about stuff you're not talking about, you don't know what you're talking about, and that kind of stuff, and you're making it up and it's all lies. And when I explain, I don't want to go into it, but when I say that in the past, this the guides are bending over backwards to get women guides because they want to be, you know, seen as being progressive and everything else, that the thumbs, like, this is happening in all kind of elite organizations globally, where if you want to get more women to be, whether it's a Navy SEAL or firewoman or fireperson or in the police, whatever, you have to change the standards. Yeah, and even if it's not, even if it's like subconscious, like if you're assessing someone to be a mountain guide, and you have a I know loads of people who failed to become mountain guides, and it was for the most arbitrary thing, like, you know, you didn't put your crampons on soon enough, or when you were belaying, your hand was, there was a rock there, and you wouldn't be, you know, your hand, you know, these are people who have been climbing for like, you know, 20 years and being told that they were belaying wrong, like they wouldn't be able to lock the rope off, or, you know, they'll, maybe it's to do with like, they don't like your personality or something, but the guides have a very high standard, and the British Mountain Guides, and, you know, I've always had like the utmost respect for them, but it seems silly to pretend that there isn't a, a general culture of we have to have more women in our organisation to in order to look more progressive and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So if you're, you know, if you're assessing a black, gay, female aspirant mountain guide and they do something that's a bit, you know, a little mistake, like, are you gonna go down on them like a ton of bricks, and they then go away and say, oh, they're all misogynistic, you know, hyper-masculine people, blah blah blah. You know, you're not. It's like, it's, you know, it's because you're doing God's work, you know, these days, you know, you're this is a factor. So for the mountain guides to get so pissed off at me I'm defending the mountain guides from being the charge that they're hyper masculine macho wankers from someone who's trying to be a mountain guide, when I would say that the mountain guides are doing everything they can to get that person through. I'm not saying individually that, I'm not saying anything about this person who wrote this article that they're not a great climber, would be a great mountain guide. I'm just saying that she should have more respect for the organization that she's trying to join, and not sully, because it's not only sullying. There's a constant thing where people are sullying and slagging off and besmirching and any other words I can think of male climbers, and it's in everything. It's not just in climbing; it's in every kind of, you know, in all culture. My son started watching Peppa Pig at the moment, and I am hypersensitive, as you can imagine, about this kind of stuff, and I am kind of shocked at how much sort of programming there is in everything he consumes, like the TV program. He basically watches like an hour of TV when he gets up at like 6 a.m, and that's it. So he doesn't watch any more TV. You just got to point that out. And I know it's weak, but, you know, what can I do? So, and, you know, but like books he reads, and there's basically an undercurrent of that men are shit. You know, men are shit and women are amazing. If you're a woman listening to this, hopefully there's not many women listening to this podcast, but if you are, you're probably just like, well, what's wrong with that? You know, like men are shit. And I often have this conversation with, because I, you know, hanging around with mums with young children, and I often sort of say, like, you know, this is my second time around being a parent, and the first time around I didn't really care about all this kind of stuff, and I was programmed to say, well, even if, well, you know, men are shit, men are, you know, I was kind of programmed to see the world through that lens. But, you know, 20 years later, I can see it more clearly, and I'll often say, like, you know, unless you take this thing seriously, you know, you do realize, although you are a woman, that child is a boy, and his outcomes in his life are going to be affected by all these kind of things. Like, there's a reason why so many men are killing themselves. You know, it's not just because they're shit. You know, there's like I think about my own life. I'm going to sound a bit like Jordan Peterson here, but there is a real, like, if you're going to have, if you're a man or you're a woman, there's like an operating system that's been developed over, you know, a million years, potentially, you know, it's over tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of being the man or the, you know, the man or the woman, the parents, the, you know, all this kind of stuff. And only in my lifetime is that has all been dismantled, and we'll get rid of it and all this kind of stuff. But the you can't really get rid of the operating system because that's how we operate. So you're trying to, like, you're trying to put things over the top of it that are kind of trying to cancel it out, but in a really clunky way. So this is an example. Like, I am not a misogynist. I have like two daughters. I was brought up by a single mother who was a single parent. Like, I've spent my life climbing and going on trips with like women, and I think women climbers are amazing and all this kind of stuff. So I'm not, I shouldn't really defend myself, but this is going to sound like one of these men who are like bitter and twisted, but this is just an observation. Like, I remember when I got divorced, first time when I got divorced, I basically gave everything to my wife because she, you know, she had the kids, and I gave that, assigned my half of the house, everything we owned. I end up, like, for some reason, paying off all our debts, and all this. I did the absolute maximum possible. And I remember then, I can't remember what happened, but there was something that she said later on, like, well, you know, it was right that you give me everything, because to be honest, like, I always made more money than you. And I thought, like, this is a long time ago. I remember thinking, like, what if that was a man saying that to a woman? Like, how would that sound? And I even see this now I have people, like young women, who are basically complaining. Like, young women are doing, like, really, really successfully. Some of them have got their own businesses, or they're doing really, really well. And they're basically bitching about their boyfriends, how shit they are, or their husbands, how shit they are, because they've got, like, a shit job, and they're not, you know, they're just shit, basically. They're useless, you know, because they're, why haven't they got, you know, like, and really, I always say, well, because you've got their job. Like, once upon a time, men did all these jobs, and then now women do a lot of these jobs. You know, like, you know, you're the teacher. Before, 50 years ago, it was mainly men. And, like, you went to university. Like, when I was a kid, it was something like two-thirds of men went to university. You know, two-thirds of university students were men. And now it's like one-third or something. You know, you had a complete flip in society. So it's not misogynistic to point these things out. And when someone in this article about mountain guides calls men who are mountain guides hyper-masculine, like, what they're saying, I know this is going to sound like Jordan Peterson here, but it's about, like, competency. You know, when you see, like, one of my heroes is, like, Jocko Willink, because for me, he is someone who's operating with that old operating system. That's very, you know, like, there's, just because you have traditional view of, like, masculinity and hard work and, you know, being a strong person and a good father and a moral sort of person, it doesn't make you, like, a rapist, basically, or a violent, you know, misogynistic person. It's actually it's a bit like, you know, when people are Christians, like, I used to think, like, when someone said the Bible was my, you know, like Bear Grylls or something, you know, when he's talking about reading the Bible, whatever, I was, oh, that's so naff. But I actually, at this point in my life, I think that those people who are basing their operating system is working on something that's very, very ancient, they're actually much more stable because they have something to believe in and some kind of framework. Where I think a lot of people don't anymore. So, you know, having a go at these climbers who make a living in the mountains being hyper masculine, they're not. They're just hyper competent because they do it, you know, a lot. And, you know, I know a lot of mainly, like, American, Canadian female mountain guides who are just, like, you know, incredible people. You know, it's not because they're hyper competent because they're incredible. It's not, they're incredible, but they're because they're hyper competent. It's in their character to be hyper competent at something. So, but you would never say, "Oh, that woman, you know, she's like a man." You know, the way she kind of, like, swaggers around climbing really hard. It's just some people are hyper competent at things. They're just really good at it. It's not about being macho. It's not about being anything else. And I think a lot of those criticisms of people it's kind of jealous. You're kind of jealous at them. Like, I do it myself. You know, you want to diminish somebody some standard you can't achieve. You know, if you can't, you know, say if you can't do loads of pull-ups or something, you know, you always try and find a reason why someone is so much better than you. Like, they're richer, their parents were posh, you know, they went to a better school, or, you know, you just make up all these kind of lies, really, in your head, which aren't which don't really serve you well. So I don't like to be like arguing with people. This thing about that the scales have been tipped in the past. Like I don't want to go into it, but I'm not lying about this. And when I've set this out to these people who I've now lost as friends, they'll admit that that happened in the past, but that was in the past, this they'll say. But I'd say the pressure now is, and I don't actually mind if you change the standards, if you adjust the standards to have more women mountain guides. Like maybe the standards are wrong, and that's not the thing I got pissed off about. I just get pissed off at this general that it doesn't serve that person writing the article or in their life to have this view of that men are the problem. You know, like, you know, if guides were less hypermasculine in the past, there'd be more women. Now I know lots of women who became mountain guides or became professional in some degree like that, and the limiting factor is always that they end up having kids, because that's just the way it is. You can be the most like militant feminist in your 20s, but you get to 30 something and all you want to do, you know, you see a baby and you just burst out, you know, somebody else's baby, you just burst into tears, and that's how it is. And that is another issue that we're all trying to deal with, because we're trying to overlay this other operating system. And I can see it in every day of my life, of people struggling with trying to, you know, be this kind of fictional, you know, woman, or this, or man being a fictional man, or whatever. Or it's trying to talk about these things rationally and have a conversation about them is how you, like, that's how the operating system gets to get made in the first place, because people talk about it. You know, that sometimes you can get angry with each other, you know, but you're trying to work out like how. This is like a personal thing, is you're trying to make a model of how to see the world. And I don't, back to the, like with the Ukraine thing, having a model that isn't connected to material reality is not going to serve you well, because the more it doesn't work, the more you'll just add a bit more code to it to ignore that, or this isn't important, or this is a, you know, that's a misogynistic view, or blah blah blah. But the same with all these, with immigration, and we were just watching this film, The Swimmer, you know, about these two Syrian girls who come over from Syria to end up in Germany and things. And I'm kind of watching it, and Vanessa's like watching it, and Vanessa, you know, it's like this is like the male mind and the female mind. Like Vanessa is all kind of empathy and compassion and care and love, and you know, like why can't we just let everyone, you know, 300 million people just come and live in Germany and we'll look after them and all this kind of stuff, and it's so horrible that they have to go that blah, blah. And where I've got like the male brain, and I'm just seeing all the practical problems of, and all the you know, like the blowback, and the suddenly you've got like far right governments appearing in Sweden of all places, and it's a lot of these problems to do with immigration or whatever would potentially not be happening if people were allowed to talk about them without sounding like a racist. Luckily, I don't have any social tenure anymore, so I don't really have to worry about these things. But you know, it is a real problem, especially when like people say I've got thin skin, and I have, but that's part of my character. Like I'm a very sensitive person. That's why I can write, you know, that's why I write the kind of things I write, you know, because I'm very, I, I, I notice really small things. That's why I write books about technical things, because I can see the importance of a really, really small detail that if you highlight it, it actually could save someone's life or something. Or when you're writing more creative stuff, it's being able to, you know, see very subtle things in people that are actually quite interesting. Because I actually had a message yesterday from somebody saying how, looking through my social media, they basically thought I was going kind of insane, really, and they hoped I was okay and all that kind of stuff. And like for me, like although I tried to get off social media, for me, like something like Instagram, it's a way of kind of, you know, what people really want you to do, we should all just stand there with our hands held high going, you know, long live Chairman Mao. But that's kind of not in my character. Like I'd be the person on the back of the lorry getting taken off to get shot, probably, because you know, and for me, just posting something on Instagram, some shit take on what's going on in the world or whatever, is like a little bit of like resistance and a little bit of demonstrating to me that I'm not willing. Like often when people will, I don't get many people follow me on social media anymore. But if somebody will, attack what you're saying, you know, that my general response is like, you know, who are you to sort of try and modify my, you know, to control what I can say or something? Because they're basically people want you to just agree with their view, and or just make you shut up or just leave social media or whatever. So you can come across, you know, looking kind of, you know, mental, going like bloody women or whatever. But these are really important. These are like crucial. Someone was saying you shouldn't, it's all just like culture war bullshit, it doesn't really matter. And it's like, well, you know, if you said that, you know, in communist China, in the Cultural Revolution, you could say the same thing. Yeah, your teacher was being beaten to death with a stick and all this kind of stuff, sent off to a gulag or whatever. But, you know, these things are kind of, it's not just a culture war. It is affecting people's, you know, lives and futures and everything else. But I think, but ultimately, it is a losing battle. Like you just can't fight it. But I think maybe I just like struggle. I just like to struggle against things, and it makes me. I think for me, any kind of struggle somehow creates some kind of energy. You know, there's some kind of energy there. Like I could just give up. Just give up and you know, not care. And I think when my mum died, after a while, because I think my mum died after having her fourth shot, is that you know, there's part of you just sort of gives up. And what's the point? But then I think there is something in some people where, you know, you do sort of like, you know, like, wait, you know, you look at your, you, I look at my son, or, you know, see, oh my, you know, you just something happens where you're like, no, you've got to keep, you know, even if it's just for yourself, even if it's completely pointless, you got to get that flag and go and stand in front of the tank, you know. Yeah, so it's because there are other people out there who feel the same. I think the majority of people feel the same, but the majority of people don't, you know, they're not allowed to say things. So if somebody else is doing it, being a pain in the ass, then you know, that used to be something that we used to celebrate when I was a kid, like people who were pains in the ass, who were, you know, I don't know, maybe it's a shock of the new, it's like future shock, you can't, maybe I'm not meant, maybe I'm meant to die. Maybe to die about But look, even my daughter, who's only 20, is she 21 or is she 24? Anyway, she's 20-something. She, you know, even for her, the world has changed so much in her lifetime that everyone's dealing with this future shock. Like, you know, when she was, when was she born? 98. So she, you know, even when she was a little, you know, little kid, you know, none of us had mobile phones really, and the internet wasn't really a thing, and streaming and all that kind of stuff. You know, she was still probably watching Barney the Dinosaur on like a scratched DVD. And so, yeah, so everyone feels it. And I guess now you've got AI here. So, you know, those things are going to accelerate even more. So, yeah, interesting times. But anyway, so I'm going to have to go out soon. So I have a, this is not just me ranting on. I wasn't going to speak for so long, but it's, you know, I'm just trying to do the logo, the badge thing for the podcast. But I am actually going to do this podcast, Radioactive Dog Shit, the Radioactive Dog Shit podcast. Like I was saying to my other son, Ewan was over. And I was saying to Vanessa, I'm going to do this podcast. It's going to be called Radioactive Dog Shit. And she was like, that's the worst podcast name I've ever heard. Then Ewan was like, oh, I don't think it's like that bad. And I was like, well, if Ewan, he's 21, he knows this kind of stuff. I'm going to do it. You can actually use the word shit as well in a podcast, a title, without having to put like, you know, things in it. So this is, in a way, this is going to be me offloading this part of the podcast of where I'm kind of ranting and raving onto a different podcast. And that, it didn't really matter if no one ever listens to that podcast, because in a way it's going to be like this. It's going to be like Instagram, but probably a more productive version of Instagram. And I think on the, Should it be called Andy Kirkpatrick's Radioactive Dog Shit, or just Radioactive Dog Shit? So I don't know if I mentioned this before, but the term Radioactive Dog Shit comes from Chuck Pratt, who I think it was Chuck Pratt, who said, because he was a really good rock climber, and he never did any mountaineering, and he said, I view snow like radioactive dog shit. So I've got this idea for this podcast, and what it's going to be is just me trying to work out if I'm actually mental, because I do spend quite a lot of time wondering if I'm mental, like seriously losing my mind. And so I had this idea of like trying to explore, you know, what's real, what's not real, what's helpful, what's not helpful, how this, you know, what kind of model am I working on, what bits are good, what bits are bad, you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so it's got nothing to do with climbing. So it's just something, again, I don't have time to do this podcast, so I'm going to do that. I don't know, but it's good to aspire to something else. Anyway, I do have a question here from somebody that I should cover, because it's supposed to be about climbing. And it's about abseiling, and I just read it and then we'll see if we can work out what the answer could be. Dear Andy Kirkpatrick, I hope this email finds you well. I recently read your book Down, very nice book, and I also encountered an abseil situation in which I had an idea how to solve it that I'm not sure you covered and would be interested in your opinion on it, and B, I would be interested in what your approach would be like. The situation: we had to make a 45-meter abseil according to the topo, and had a single 80-meter climbing rope, along with some cord and slings, etc. Both climbers are clipped with carabiners, a tube, and a gree-gree each. Both anchors were well-equipped abseil anchors with bolts, a chain, and a large fixed quick link. The terrain seemed prone to snagging of knots and blocking carabiners. At first, we tried to make a blocking rappel, i.e. we tied a locking carabiner into one of the strands and clipped the other with the pull strand made long enough with the blah, blah, blah. I'm thinking. I'll try and work this out as I'm saying it. So I'm thinking what they tried to do is they must have been abseiling on the gree-grees. So when people abseil on a gree-gree and have a single rope, is usually what they do is they feed the rope through. So you'd have like an 80 meter rope. So you've got 40 meters hanging down on each strand. And one's got to be a pull strand, one's got to be the rappel strand. So on the pull strand, because you're going to abseil on a gree-gree on a single strand of rope, like if you did it without doing anything, the rope would just whiz through the anchor and you die. So you have to block the rope. So what you do is the way I tend to do it is where the abseil strand is passing through the anchor and becoming the pull strand, the rope you're going to pull, is you get a locking carabiner and you clove hitch the locking carabiner with a triple clove hitch, not just a double clove hitch, because it makes it a bit more stable, and you clip it into the clove hitch. So what that means is that when you put your gree-gree on the abseil strand, the carabiner is like jams into the rappel anchor, so the carabiner can't get pulled through the ring. So you can abseil down to the end of the abseil down to the next anchor, then you pull the pull strand. The pull strand pulls down the blocking carabiner on the clove hitch. You pull it down. You take the carabiner out, and you pull the rope down. When you're using a blocking system, you always have to really make sure that the carabiner cannot pass through. Like if you have like a ring, if there's like an abseil ring, then a carabiner cannot pass through the abseil ring. And the worst thing that could probably happen with an abseil ring is if you didn't use a locking carabiner, that potentially somehow the carabiner could clip into the ring, like it was being pulled in a funny direction. But when you're setting up a blocking carabiner, you always need to, you know, load it, check how it's set and stuff. You know, like if you were really cack-handed, you might say you, instead of being a ring, it was like a big like a big cargo hook. What do they call it? A mussy hook, like a big carabiner that you can clip the rope into. Potentially something that was very large would be large enough for a carabiner to pull through it. So if you were like abseiling on it, then the blocking carabiner might just like pull through the abseil point and then you die. So one way people often try to avoid that happening is they'll clip the carabiner into the abseil rope. So you got the pull line, you got the clove hitch with a locker in the clove hitch, and then the rope is going through the abseil point, and then you clip the abseil rappel rope back into the carabiner. So that means that even if the carabiner was somehow to work its way through the abseil point, it's kind of secured inside the carabiner. That does create like a little bit more friction. So there's various ways of doing the blocking. You can some people tie a figure of eight and then clip that into the knot is blocking the carabiner, really. There's loads of ways of doing it. One way of doing it is if you have a really small mayon or you could use a piece of a cord, like make a really small loop, then you don't really need a carabiner. Like you could just tie a big knot. As long as the knot can't pull through it, then that's one way of doing it. You could do it instead of having a a blocking thing, and it's a really good anchor, then both climbers could abseil down the same time using on a gree-gree each. But you need to. But that is, I would kind of avoid ever doing like a simultaneous abseil, because it's just too dangerous, and there's so many people die doing it. It's just not worth it. Not many people do it. and yet there's quite a lot of accidents with it. So that shows that it's probably not very good. Now, a classic way you're going to die doing a simultaneous abseil is you're abseiling down, you and your mate, you've got your gree-grees on, you're going down the rope, you're the first person gets to the belay, you know, because you can't really be, one person's generally above the other person, because otherwise you're just banging into each other. First person gets to the belay, they clip into the belay, they pull on the handle, and the rope whizzes through the belay there of gree-gree, the knot goes, you know, there's no knot on the end, whizzes through, the other person flies down, or they get to the belay, they clip in, they pull on the handle to get some slack. As the slack flies through the gree-gree, the other person flies down the rope because you're suddenly giving them slack. They might pull on the handle on their gree-gree out of panic. So what does the one person is flies down, hits the other person panics, they pull on the handle even more, and before you know it, you know, someone's dead. So ways to avoid that is both climbers should tie into the end of tie into the rope, don't clip into the rope, tie into the rope, into each person ties into the end of the rope. So therefore, you know, whatever happens, you know, no one's going to go off the end of the rope, you know, so you're tied into it, and, you know, you're counterbalanced, you know, even if both gree-grees were to break, you know, you would just both fall to the end of the rope, you'd be dangling there wondering what the hell happened. You could clip into each other with a sling, get a 120 centimeter sling, clip into each other, and that would mean that if the person got to the end of the belay, you know, and they untied from the knot, and the rope whizzed through the gree-gree, the other person's not going to fall to the death, they're actually connected to the person. So, you know, but people do it because they think it's going to be a lot quicker. But since you've got like a belay tube, ideally what you want to do is just like feed the rope through an abseil, you know, put a backup prussic on the rope, and abseil down on the on your belay tube. That would save a hell of a lot of fannying on, really. I think people, because they use a gree-gree so much, they kind of feel like they're safer on the gree-gree. Like there are benefits, you know, there are kind of benefits using gree-gree abseiling, but a belay tube is the thing to use, really. So at first we tried to make a blocking, he calls it a reap schnewer. Sounds like a sort of some Derbyshireism, like, hey, it was a reap schnewer rappel, i.e. we tied a locking carabiner to one of the strands and clipped the other with the pull strand made long enough for some reap schnewer. But on the first pull test, so pull test is like one of the key things to do if you don't want to have accidents or get stuck abseiling, is the first person abseil down and they pull the rope, pull like a meter on the rope to test it's going to pull, which is a really, really, really good technique. You don't want to all abseil down and be standing at the bottom belay and then realize the rope's not going to pull. Like if it doesn't pull, generally there's there's too much friction or whatever. So this is a very good technique to adopt. But on the first pull test with the abseil down, the rope blocking carabiner immediately got stuck on the first opportunity. With many more such opportunities on the way. Remember once I was climbing in Australia and we climbed at this, what's it called? It was like this crag. It was like out in the outback. I can't remember what it's called now, but it was out in the outback and you had to walk up this mountain every morning to get to the, it was like an escarpment. Is it escarpment? And it was like Stanage, but made out of, and it was like an Australian Stanage, but it was much higher. And anyway, there was a point where there was an abseil, some abseil points, abseil down, and where they drilled the abseil, there was the edge of the rock, and there was a notch right there. And I remember saying to Vanessa, I think it's time for me to. I'm gonna have to pause this podcast because I have to go and take this child for a walk, and I shall get back to it. You won't even notice it'll just be seamless. So anyway, so I'll see you in probably half a second. Okay, bye. Right, back again. It's now sunny outside. You probably hear someone mowing the lawn or something. So, where were we? Found my that email again. It's funny when you do podcasts and you kind of do them in two halves, usually when I do a podcast, I'll just record whatever, and then I'll just fire it off. But when you're in two halves, you kind of go away and you're like, oh my god, what the hell was I talking about or something. Or anyway, so it's always a bit weird doing it in two halves. So where were we? Blah blah blah. So on the first pull test, the rope blocking carabiner immediately got stuck on the first opportunity. Oh yeah, so I was saying that when I was in this crag in the Rapalese, where the abseil was, there was a ledge with like two bolts in the ledge, and then the rope went over the edge. So that it's always best to have the bolts on like the flat on a face somewhere. So you. Because as soon as you have a bolt belay or abseil anchor on the vertical, it means that the rope is going to be at sort of 90 degrees. Is that right? 90 degrees? 180 degrees? Anyway, it's at right angle. You know, that's always going to cause some kind of quite a large amount of friction. And anyway, but where the anchor was, there was like a small kind of notch that was probably maybe like 20 centimeters, sort of, you know, 20 centimeter deep notch. And I guess most people would not even see it. And especially the person who placed the abseil anchor there didn't see it. So I think Vanessa abseil down first. And then when she did the pull test, you could see the rope just immediately sort of went into this notch. So even though the notch was tiny, because you were pulling directly underneath it, the knot just got jammed into this thing. There was no way you were going to overpower it. It was just stuck in there. So so what I did, I just as I was abseiling over the edge, I just let some of the abseil, because you've got the rope is going through the part you've got the abseil, basically you're abseiling on both strands, which are tied together because we had a belay device. So you've got both ropes going through it. But say if you're pulling on the pink rope, not that it was pink, if you're pulling on the pink rope, then you let some of the green rope slide through your belay device while holding onto the pink rope, and it migrates the knot. So the knot starts following you as you start going over the edge. So you just get the knot over the edge where this notch is, and it means it doesn't jam up anyway. So when we went down to the campsite that night, there was another, like, three people staying there. We were like, oh, we were like abseiling off this popular anchor, and we noticed this thing, and you know, it's just worth being aware of it. And they just kind of like poo-pooed, because we were probably like nobbers what we were climbing. They probably just thought, oh, what do they know? Anyway, the next day they came down and they're like, oh, our rope got stuck on the abseil, so it's still up there. So it's good to observe these things. So the rope blocking carabiner immediately got stuck on the first opportunity, with many more such opportunities on the way. Here I, as the first abseiler, observed that the single 80mm rope does in fact suffice. So you actually reach the abseil on an 80 meter rope where the topo said it was a 90 meter rope. which is kind of unusual, you know. So I guess like a 45-meter abseil is, I guess that would be like a classic length of abseil in the past, because you'd have two ropes tied together. And it's only like modern climbing where you have these abseils set up. Like, usually they're set up for like 28 meters apart or something, so you can abseil on a single 60. But in some countries, like in the US and stuff, as people have started getting like 70-meter sport climbing ropes, these the abseils are maybe like 30 meters apart, which is a bit of a pain in the arse, which is obviously what this person is thinking about. So anyway, so it's ropes. So it's an anticlimax. So the rope actually did suffice. So here, when you're abseiling and you're not sure if your ropes are going to reach the end, this is where you really want to, ideally, like you can either tie knots into the end of the rope and clip them into your harness, or you can just tie knots into the end of the rope and let them dangle down. And whenever you connect the rope directly to you, the downside of that is you'll get like sort of kinks and knots like building up as you're abseiling down, because the rope can't spin out all the kind of twists and things that you're creating in the rope. Like, one way to avoid that, if you want to keep hold of the ends of the rope, is so that's why you should always tie the ends of the rope separately. You don't want to tie both ropes together, because that makes it even worse. So if both ropes are separate, that's why when you abseil down, the ropes just unfurl, the knots and twists just come out as you're abseiling down. But if you connect them to your harness, then that doesn't happen. So one way to get over that is to connect the ends of the rope, ends of your rope, into your harness. Use it with a sling. So if you use like a 60-centimeter sling or whatever, then what happens is the twists like go into the sling. They don't go into the rope. Does work it through, but then it's just a bit of a more fanning on. So anyway, but if you're not quite sure if your rope's going to reach the next belay, it's quite good to you don't want to abseil off the end of it, and also you don't want to do the thing where you get there and you basically have zero rope left in your hand. You know, the ends of the rope are in your hand and your hand is next to the belay device and the belay is just below you, and you're like, oh, maybe I could just like reach down and clip into it. Like there's a really famous, well, it's not that famous a story, but two guys are abseiling down El Cap and they had 60 meter ropes maybe, and the belays were further than 60 meters apart. And what happened was one of them was abseiling down and he had the haul bag, which is, you know, pretty heavy, and he could only just reach to this belay if he untied the knots in the abseil ropes. So he just managed to reach down, managed to clip the belay. Probably what it was, he was probably abseiling down and he was actually abseiling to a belay that wasn't on the route they were on. That must be what it was. So he anyway, managed to clip into this belay, let go of the ropes. He fell onto the belay, which is not a good idea, and the ropes like pinged up. But he didn't tell his friend. So because he had the haul bag, he was a lot heavier, so the ropes had stretched a lot more. So when his friend was coming down, his friend's just looking down and sees this guy in the belay, just assumes the rope is reaching down to him. And as he gets towards the end of the rope, he suddenly, both ropes whiz through his hands. This is El Cap, remember, he's a long way off the ground. And as he's falling, he grabs the haul bag, the straps on the haul bag, and he saves himself. And I guess at that point, your two ropes would like ping up into space, and now they'd be like 5 meters above you. So how they got out of that situation, I don't really know. So it's good to be a little bit paranoid about these things. So he obviously probably did that. So he realized his ropes fit reach, because often your rope might say it's like 80 meters long, but if you actually measured it, it'd probably be a lot longer, because rope lengths are not precise, really. If you get two ropes, especially if you get two ropes from different manufacturers, you'll always find that one of them is like 2 meters longer than the other one, which is a complete pain in the arse when it comes to you know, sort of like, you know, taking in the rope. Because when it comes tight on the second, it's like, they're taking on the green. It's like, it just drives you insane. So that's why it's quite good to have, ropes of the same manufacturer. So, so it does in fact suffice. And so the situation was resolved. And I was wondering whether what would have you done in the other case. So we're talking here about a scenario where you have a single rope, it's 80 meters long, and you have the belay, the bolt belay below you is 45 meters away. So you are 5 meters short on the end of each rope. So you get to the end of your rope, which you've doubled up because you have to retrieve it, and you are still 5 meters, stroke 15 feet, stroke 100 yards, whatever that is. You're 15 hands. You can't get to the belay. So his idea is, I had about 15 meters of 7 mm Rappenschnur, which I'm guessing that's like cord, with the breaking strain of 10 kilonewtons with me as the leader. So it's a cordlet, I'm guessing. And considered tying that to one of the strands and to the lower anchor so that the other strand could be fixed and could be rappelled on without requiring a blocking construction at the upper anchor. Afterwards, the rope would be pulled on the side that was fixed with a Rappenschnur, the cord, with only the lower 10 meters possibly causing problems. I don't really understand what he's saying there. Would you consider that idea safe? I don't really understand. Other ideas I had, abseiling on two strands of the climbing rope and the Rappenschnur with a munter which passes the knot. Problem is, I'm not sure the prussic would work on a 7 mm Rappenschnur. Some ghosting technique. I have not used these techniques yet, but I can imagine they also solving this kind of situation. However, from what I've read, I imagine these would be dangerous. Would be more dangerous than my idea. Would you agree? Happy to hear your thoughts. Best regards, Leon. I shall keep your name. Keep your second name. I'll just call you Leon Hendrial instead of anyway. So I think I kind of know what you're saying. So if for me, so there's a few times where I've had this. More than a few times I've had like where the ropes wouldn't reach the next belay, abseil anchor. So in the winter time, like it depends. And there's millions of variables. So I'm thinking now, once in New Zealand, what we did was I think we must have had like a single rope. Do we have a double rope? Anyway, it just wouldn't reach down to where the anchor was. So whether we'd missed an anchor, or it was like on an alpine route. So what I did was so you've got your two ropes and you've got your pull strand, which we'll call it red. We'll call it purple for pull, and you've got your other strand, which isn't going to be a rappel strand. We'll call that's green. So if you imagine you've got your pull strand, the knot is on that side of the anchor, so that when you get to the bottom, you're going to pull purple, and then the rope's going to pull through. But you abseil down, and you realise you're like 5 meters short of the next anchor. So what are you going to do? Because you've already abseiled down, so you're probably not going to go all the way back up again. And I think in what happened in that situation was because I could get my weight off the rope. I already had a knot in the end of both ropes, the figure of eight. So I took the figure of eight. And I clipped that into my harness with a locker on the purple rope, and then Vanessa, my wife, she put a prussic on the purple rope, And I was able to get my weight off, and she actually put me on belay on the other rope, on the whatever colour it was. Oh, I forgot what colour it was, the blue rope or something. The rope that was going to go up when I was going down. And then I just started, I untied the knot in the other rope, in the bottom of the rope. So I'm now like hanging on the pull rope with my belay device, with my abseil device, and the rope's going through my abseil device into my harness. And Vanessa like put me onto belay on the rope that I've just untied from. And I just started like down climbing, and as I was down climbing, I was placing. Oh no! Did I climb up? I basically started placing gear in the purple rope and clipping it in. And as I was down climbing, and so I was like placing gear, going down. And I suppose you could have built another anchor, but the anchor we're going to was like a very good anchor. So I was like placing gear, down climbing, just letting the rope go through the other rope, going through my belay device until eventually it just like popped out. And then just kept on down climbing. And then I got to the belay, connected myself to the belay. And then my wife pulled up the end of the... So now the other rope is 10 meters short of the belay, because it's gone. I've gone down 10 meters. I've gone down 5 meters. So I was short 5 meters. So I down climbed 5 meters. So now the other end of the rope is like 10 meters above me. This is very, very complicated. So so basically she went up and she abseiled down. She pulled up the other rope. So she tied a knot in the end again, clipped into that. So she couldn't abseil off the end of that rope. And she abseiled down until she was tight on the other rope. She was 10 meters above me. She tied a knot into the rope, clipped into it with a screw get or something. And then she started down climbing. And as she was down climbing, the end of the rope, and I had her on belay. As she started down climbing, the end of the rope just came through the belay device, the up rope. And she down climbed, taking the protection out of that place until she arrived. Then we pulled the rope down and off we went. So that is, you know, sometimes in the past you'd be like, you just get to the end of the rope and you're like, I'm just going to down climb to this belay. You abseil down and then you just down climb to me. But in that situation where we were, it was like a massive drop underneath us. It was dark. It wasn't. I remember once on the Drew, on the backside of the Drew, abseiling down the Grand Drew in Chamonix, and a guy was with like abseil down, and it was dark. We were knackered, you know, being awake all night and stuff. Abseil down, and he couldn't hear anything. And I was like, oh god, what's going on? And then I could hear like someone shouting. It's like something. So. Anyway, so I got the rope kind of goes slack. So I put my belay device on, I start abseiling down. And he basically abseiled into like a chimney. And he was just kind of bridged in this chimney, but he was still attached to the rope. So, you know, we didn't think there was a vertical rock face underneath us. We thought it was just gonna be like snow all the way down to the glacier, and it was stuck in a chimney. Actually that's happened more than once. So you know, when it's dark and things, that's when you just want to be a lot more careful. But if it came to a steep rock, a steep vertical face, and you're 10 meters, you're 5 meters short of getting to the belay, so there what you do is you would basically, so you got your middle mark on your rope, so you know that you've got 40 meters, I mean, 20 meters on one side, 20 meters on the other side. Is that right? No, 40 meters on one side, 40 meters on the other side. So what you would do, you would get the length of your cordelette. So you get your cordelette. So say your cordelette is, you know, for 50 meters, that's 15 meters, quite a long cordelette. But anyway, so you get your cordelette. Maybe you need to get your mate's cordelette. Maybe you need to get your cordelettes, and you have to get your cord off your choke bag, or maybe you have to get all your slings, maybe you have to get your shoelaces. You know, like if you put all the slings and all the cord and everything you have, you know, the pull things out of your rucksack and everything else, all your quick draws, everything. If you put it all together, you've probably got about 30 meters there anyway. So, but what you would do is say you've got 7 meters of cordelette. So you untie your cordelette, you've got this long strand of cordelette, is you've got the middle mark of the rope, and you would just measure out, you would put the end of the cordelette next to the middle mark, and you would start measuring it out until you have lowered out that 7 meters of rope onto the, so your cordelette, you've lowered 7 meters extra rope. So that means, I'll call it 10 meters because I'm really not very good at maths. So at the moment you've got 40 meters on either side, and now what you're going to do, you're going to lower an extra 10 meters on one side. So that means you've got 30 meters, you've got a 30 meter strand hanging down one side, and you've got, so you had 40, now you've got 30 meters on one side, and you've got 50 meters on the other side hanging down. And then where that is, you do a blocking technique. So you pull the rope, put a carabiner in, whatever, however you want to do it. So you're just going to abseil down on the strand, which is 50 meters long. Then you pull up your other end of the rope, which is now 20 meters short, 50 meters short. You're going to pull that up, and you're going to tie in the end of your cordelette into that strand of rope. So your abseil line is completely solid, goes all the way down to the next anchor, and then your pull line goes down for 30 meters, and then it's got a knot in it, and then the knot is going down to 7 meters of cordelette. So you abseil down. You pull test it, just check that it's going to pull okay. So you get down, you grab the end of the cordelette, start pulling on it, the rope starts moving, it's good, pull it down, and the next person comes down and you pull it down. So you have a slightly increased risk because you've got a knot, but it's not a problem, because it's the end right near you. You know, 7 meters above you, you can see it, you can flick it or whatever, you can get it down okay. So in like an extreme case, that kind of technique is always really good if your ropes get damaged. Say you've got two ropes and you're climbing in the Alps, and you know you have you've got to do big abseils to get down, and if one of your ropes gets damaged, then you can just tie the rope together, tie that rope together with loads of knots. So it doesn't matter, you're only abseiling down on the rope which has got no knots in it, which is a complete, and the other rope, which is your pull rope, could be made up of anything you can pull. Basically, it could be string, it could be anything. So yeah, so that would be a way to do it. Now, a ghosting technique is where you basically, how the rope is attached to the anchor in some way that when you pull on the pull strand, it just breaks apart, like the knot or whatever you're using is designed that when you pull on the pull strand or the pull part of the rope, it just dismantles the knot or whatever. So the most famous, there's a lot of kind of weird, I can't recall them, like these knots where you abseil on one end and you pull on the other and it just falls apart. They're kind of trick knots, really. They're not really anything I would ever recommend anyone to use. A fiddlestick is something where you tie a stone knot, which is a bit like a figure of eight, and you put this piece of plastic, what's it called? It's made out of the same stuff, lexicon, or it's made, you make nalcyon bottles out of it. This kind of stick, plastic bar that goes into the stone knot, and it stops the stone knot from coming undone. And then when you get to the end, you pull the stick out. It's attached to a rope or some cord, and the knot collapses, and then it just falls out of the anchor. So you use that technique if you're abseiling off a massive tree or a massive boulder, and you don't want to pull the whole rope all the way through it. So, that doesn't necessarily work in this situation. Basically, what you're trying to do, instead of you try, instead of having, the middle of the rope ends up at the bottom of the rappel rather than at the top, if that makes any sense. So the ends of the rope are actually at the top when you're abseiling, and then you're pulling on one of the ropes to somehow dismantle that thing. Now, probably the best technique, you'd have to read my book to work out how to do it. Now, this is a technique that I don't think anybody ever did or ever even knew existed. But since I wrote that book, it's actually, you'll see it on TikTok or something. But you basically tie a bowline around the whatever it is. So this would be, you'd put the rope through the abseil anchor and tie a bowline. And then the other end of the rope is used to basically break apart the bowline. It pulls the, the heart of the bowline, kind of pulls the heart of the bowline out, and then it pulls the other strand through. And it's very clever how it works. Well, it's not clever because it's just how it works very, very well. And you're abseiling on a bowline, so long as you know tie bowline, it's also safe to do so. And you would use your 7 meters of cord let at that end, because you wouldn't have enough rope to reach. It'd be pointless to do this a bowline a ghost anchor if you're at reach. So the other end of your rope is short, so you just tie the cord let onto that, and it goes up, and it goes and is attached to the bowline, and it would like pull the bowline apart, and you could pull it down. But like then you've got like, I don't know, you've got two ends of rope falling down with that technique. So it's a technique for some things, but it's for this, I would probably just do the blocking technique. I think that's the way to do it. I've seen people again. It's since down came up. Like this is all covered in down. One way to do it is if it was like to get to the ground, like often because you've got the problems of like glacial retreat and various things, you can sometimes get to the point where you say you're on a slab, like a massive slab, and you know you have enough rope. Say it's, you know, it's like 60 meters to the ground, but you only have one 60-meter rope and you can't see any other anchor whatsoever. There's this thing, it's called like a deadfall. I invented it. I call it a deadfall, which is when a branch falls out of a tree and kills you. So but a deadfall, it's kind of a variation of a blocking technique. So basically you have your rope, 60-meter rope, it goes all the way down to the ground. You have to make sure it goes down to the ground, otherwise it doesn't work. Goes all the way down to the ground, and it goes through the anchor. You create like a blocking system so you can rappel on that rope, and you just then attach something heavy like a rucksack or something into the other end of the rope. So what it does is that you would have it backed up for the first person down rappels down, and then the last person abseils down, and when the rope is unweighted, the weight of the rucksack falls and it pulls the rope through and back down. It pulls the whole thing back down to the ground, basically like a counterweight, like a deadfall trap type thing. It's not foolproof. The rope could get tangled in the rucksack. There's all sorts of things that can happen, but it's one of those situations where I've abseiled off things, and you've come to some overhanging, you know, horror show, and you'll just see like two ropes are just there, and like, you know, people have just abseiled off the ropes and just left them there, and you know they knew they could, if they tie all the ropes together, they could get down, and that's what they've done, and just left the ropes there. Or you could tie all your ropes together, so you have like 120-meter abseil. If you really want to get down to the ground, you don't care about your ropes, you do 120-meter abseil or longer if you've got longer ropes, and you would just abseil on a on a munter hitch, and when you get to the knot in the middle, you just like let the rope go through the munter hitch and then keep on going, or a super munter. which is like the ultimate kind of get out of that kind of trick. So yeah, so that's it. I can hear them coming into the house again. I got to take this goddamn child walking one more time. People must think I'm like, how can I be a misogynist when I spend like literally 3 hours of the day pushing this baby around? Like it's, I'm as modern as you're gonna, modern as you're ever gonna get me. So I did have a question about hammocks for some reason. What time is it? I've got time for a little hammock question. People are really into hammocks, aren't they? What time is that? What, 16:55 in real money? Is that 5:55? 15? That's 50. I'm not very good at 24-hour time still. I think it is. I think I have to save my hammock question. I'll have to save the hammock question because you need quite a lot of time when you're talking about hammocks. So I shall leave you to it, and so I apologise any mountain guys out there, mountain guides out there, and any women out there who've been offended by the things I've said. But that's in Corrie and Lainess, what does he say? I play the man I am, and that's what I do. So anyway, until next time, goodbye.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.